hppodcraft.com.
I had a strange feeling of unreality as I posted the letter, and waited with mixed feelings of impatience and lingering and also regathering incredulity for his reply. When it came, quite a fat one, it rekindled all my first excitement, though without satisfying all my curiosity by any means. Wilmarth was still inclined to write off his and his colleagues' deductions about my word choices, dreams, and fantasies as lucky guesses, though he told me enough about the project to keep my curiosity in a fever, especially about its discoveries of obscure linkages between the life of the imagination and archaeological discoveries in far-off places. He seemed particularly interested in the fact that I generally never dreamed and that I slept for very long hours. He overflowed with thanks for my cooperation and my invitation, promising to include me on his itinerary when he drove west. And he had a lot more questions for me.
Pfeiffer, I have questions for you. What is your favorite word? What is your least favorite word? If heaven exists, what would you like to hear God say when you arrived at the pearly gates? I borrowed these questions from the late James Lipton. Rest in peace.
Yeah, he was a cool guy. He was somebody who was easy to caricature, but I always appreciate the sort of bravery it takes to be enthusiastic about something in a world that always wants to dull your edges. You know, that guy just, he loved acting, was enthusiastic about it, and that's really cool. To answer your questions, my favorite word is murder. It's not that I'm into the act of it. You know, don't get it twisted. It's nothing about that. I just think it's a cool word. I like the sound of it.
Okay, sure.
It's got a lot to offer about it. You know, it's two syllables. Other things I like about it, like that. My least favorite word is probably more of a phrase, if I could stretch it a bit. It's a German phrase, bitte tote mich nicht. I think that's how you say it, bitte tote mich nicht, which roughly translates in English to please don't murder me. And again, it's not about, you know, I just hate the sound of it. Hate the sound of that phrase. And if God exists, I'd like him to say, that was cool what you said about James Lipton, man. The enthusiasm thing. I bet you're real proud of yourself, which is kind of sarcastic. So I'll be like, whatever, God. And then I'll put on some sunglasses. So those are my answers to those questions. Wow. Wilmarth has a whole other set of questions in that letter.
He does. Questions for Georg Fischer that will be addressed as we discuss the Fritz Leiber story, The Terror from the Depths, on the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast. I'm Chris Lackey.
And I'm Chad Pfeiffer. We're here at hppodcraft.com, Patreon, and in a tunnel that looks kind of like, you know, the dreams of a monster? The dreams of a monster.
I know well. The dreams of a monster from reality.
Who was that reader?
That reader is the extremely capable Andrew Lehman.
That was the extremely capable Andrew Lehman. Every time a bell rings, you know, they say an angel gets its wings. But every time Lehman speaks, an angel gets a jetpack.
Wow.
Of course, you can listen to more Lehman on Voluminous and fill the heavens with the fighting force of the future by doing so.
Oh, it's great stuff. Andrew and Sean Branney really rock the letters of H.P. Lovecraft and give us some insight that you probably wouldn't normally get, especially not on this show.
Especially not on this show. Yet we still push forward. Speaking of which, where the heck are we in the story? I finished it this morning with mixed feelings of impatience and lingering and also regathering incredulity.
To quickly recap, we're reading a found document written by Georg Fischer, a man found dead back in 1937.
He was found mangled and mutilated, no less. So maybe a heart attack, natural causes. Yeah. We don't know yet.
In this document, he's telling us about living in the Hollywood Hills in a stone house created by his cultist fighter father. Georg has had visions of tunnels under his house and of winged worms flying around in them. He sleeps 12 hours a day, goes for walks in the hills. He wrote a Cthulhu-y book of poetry that has gotten the attention of Albert Wilmarth from Miskatonic University, who plans on coming out for a visit in the near future. Now, Georg and Albert are pen pals of a sort.
Wow, good job. It's a pretty good summary.
Thanks.
I mean, it was pretty conventional setup, so you you described it in a way that made it interesting. All that conventional. It's like the first act of Tootsie, basically. But you made it sound interesting. Let's burrow back into the story.
Over the next few months, Georg's life was pretty much the same, going on his walks, doing his reading, but this project that Miskatonic was working on really fueled his imagination. Wilmarth writes and tells him about the events at the Mountains of Madness. Wilmarth wished he could have gone with them, but his health wasn't great.
Why does he wish he could have gone with them?
I have no idea.
Oh, I saw all the photos of them dying and going crazy on Instagram, and I just couldn't help but feel jealous. I just feel like I'm missing out.
One of the letters, Wilmarth relates the fate of Robert Blake, who is the protagonist from The Haunter in the Dark. But then we get this.
It was just after his visit to Providence that, with a curious sort of guardedness and reluctance, he mentioned visiting another colleague of sorts there who was in poor health, a Howard Phillips Lovecraft, who had fictionalized, but quite sensationally, Wilmarth warned me, some Arkham scandals and some of Miskatonic's researches and project activities. These stories had been published, when at all, in cheap pulp magazines, especially in a lurid journal called Weird Tales. You'll want to tear the cover off if you ever should dare to buy a copy, he assured me.
Again, this just goes to show you how much people love to put Lovecraft in the mythos.
Yeah.
But this is a bit different, right?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, because in this story, Lovecraft lives in a world where there really is an Arkham. So this is kind of an alternate version of Lovecraft, because Arkham's a real place that yes. he knows of and exists in. But like in Strange Eons and other stories like the Shay stuff, Lovecraft makes up Arkham, but the things that he writes about actually exist in our real world.
Right. Yeah, that's why in the last show I referenced Return of the Living Dead, because remember in that movie, Night of the Living Dead as a movie exists. James Karen's character tells the new employee, Freddy, he says, oh yeah, yeah, that all happened, but the movie didn't get it right. Usually when people insert Lovecraft into the mythos, he's a prophet. The monsters and his insights into their motives are all true, and he's using these pulp stories and this mythologized Arkham, you know, to get the truth out there about the monsters. Whereas here, all of the story elements are true, the characters and places, but he's probably stretching with the monsters, maybe. Yeah. You don't know if that's the real part or not, and that I think that's really the best way to do it. Because then he's just this kind of cranky, weird writer who's probably learning some facts through correspondence, but then infusing his worldview into them. So who knows if he's right about anything? And, yes. and the fact that his characters are all paper thin, that there aren't any subplots or set pieces that would be for pure diversion, jet ski races or anything.
No.
Because he's more like a journalist who's trying to uncover the truth. He's one of these writers who will put out an inside scoop book on whatever the latest scandal is in a way. Mm-hmm. You know, they get just yeah. some facts and then they make up salacious details to fill those in, which is sort of all writing is, you know, five writers look at a house. There are objective truths to record about it. It is a house. It's two stories. It's old. But then what each imagines is happening within the house is going to be based on whatever they're a creep about, really. Mm-hmm. You know, Dickens is thinking about abused children. Agatha Christie's got a murder going on in there. Murder. I just love saying that word. And Lovecraft's, you know, filling this house up with invisible monsters. Because that's really what he's thinking about. So as far as using Lovecraft in the mythos, I gotta say this, I give this one the award for that. I liked it.
Yeah, I agree. It's the better way to do it, I think. However, Lovecraft doesn't factor too much into the story, so it's nothing to get all wound up about.
Yeah, his head is never floating outside of a window.
But Georg gets himself some weird tales, picks up a few issues of those, and he reads up all of the Lovecraft stories. He's a bit tripped out by the Call of Cthulhu, and he wonders how much of it's real? He peppered Wilmarth with questions only to receive pacifying and temporizing answers. Finally, in 1937, Wilmarth is going to set off for California, bringing with him the geoscanner, books, papers, and a drug that Morgan developed, which induces dreaming and may, conceivably, he says, facilitate clairvoyance and clairaudience. It might make even you dream, should you consent to ingest an experimental dose.
I thought this was a funny connection to Mythos characters in here. It says, while he was gone from 118 Saltonstall, his rooms would be occupied and his cats, including his beloved Blackfellow, cared for by a close friend named Danforth, who'd spent the last 5 years in a mental hospital recovering from his ghastly Antarctic experience at the Mountains of Madness. So he's like, I'll get all these characters in here, even if it's just a cat sit. You know, Danforth's there just to watch the pet. And then, of course, the name of the cat, yeah. Blackfellow. Hopefully written with a wince. When did the story come out again? Was it in the 70s?
70s, yeah.
Yeah.
1976, yeah. Again, maybe it's a softening of Lovecraft, because obviously these people are more modern and probably knew about Lovecraft's racism.
Well, because it's in that story, you know that that's something everybody's been winking at each other about for a long time. So I think this is just Leiber's wink. If you're in the know, you're going to know what that means. And then feel however you're going to feel about it. But he's making a joke about it.
Wilmarth travels for 2 months, stopping at many places, collecting information and doing little investigations.
He's doing the tour to Lovecraft, basically.
He is, yeah. During this time, Georg is reading more Lovecraft, picking up The Shadow Out of Time and The Shadow Over Innsmouth, which strikes a little close to home for Georg, with his father disappearing into the ground, perhaps down into tunnels under the Hollywood Hills. Not unlike the protagonist from The Shadow Over Innsmouth, discovering he's a deep one, being pulled down.
Yeah, and like kind of like Tootsie, too. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. The last episode, I mentioned the lizard people in L.A. We've recorded these a little early, so I'm sure that there's plenty of comments in about it.
On the episode, I bet they're all like, there are no lizard people in L.A. What is this nonsense you're talking about, you know, by Lizard Man 39?
I found out a bit more. A story circulated in 1934 in the city of Los Angeles that there was a site discovered of maybe ancient bazaar civilization of people who worshipped lizards. This guy, G. Warren Schufelt, claimed to be a geophysicist and mining engineer. Some accounts claim that Schufelt was looking for oil or possibly gold, and he found some tunnels with his device. Now, this device sounds very similar to what Wilmar's using here.
Yeah.
It's called the self-modified radio X-ray device, and he claimed, without uncertainty, detect the presence of minerals and tunnels below the surface of the ground. This guy might have definitely been a shyster, but we're not exactly sure. Schufelt sought advice from Little Chief Greenleaf of the Hopi Nation Medicine Lodge in Arizona, and the chief also went by the name L. Macklin. He told him about the legend of the lizard people and how they had built several underground cities in the American West, in Mexico, and Central America. There's a lot about this. I don't want to get too far off track, but they weren't actually lizard people. They were people that worshipped lizards. So the story goes. And I'm sure Leiber heard these stories.
Oh, yeah. Undoubtedly, that's what he was referencing. That, or he saw the Union and the Snake video and was talking about that. It's kind of what it's like. But there are lizards all over the place here in the Southwest, and it's a credible creature to worship. Don't forget Bokrug, the great water lizard from the dune that came to Sarnath.
I could never forget
Bokrug. Lizards have been with us since the very beginning of the show.
So also at this time, mail addressed to Wilmarth began arriving at Georg's place, one of them a small package from New Orleans.
My dearest Wilmarth, please find enclosed a collection of beads from Mardi Gras. If you would be so kind as to post a return package including photographic reproductions of your breasts, I would be most pleased. I await your response with mixed feelings of impatience.
So on April 14th, Georg's 25th birthday, Wilmarth arrived in his fancy Aston Martin. Wilmarth was only in his 30s, but he looked much older. He had a very nervous vibe about him, but he tried to cover it up with joviality and enthusiasm. He asked Georg to take his bag, seemingly not caring about his limp or his twisted foot. And this made Georg like him more. Georg showed Wilmarth around the house, and he was impressed with the design, especially the engravings. He took Wilmarth down to the cellar and showed him the Gate of Dreams carving. Wilmarth asked if it was okay to use the geoscanner in the cellar, and Georg said, of course. The thing is set up like a tripod, and it has a camera-like deal on it, and you even put your head under black cloth as you use this machine to look. Wilmarth said, after a few minutes of fiddling around, he goes, hello, what's this? But then he came out from underneath the blanket and he said that the scanner's gone crankish.
It's seeing ghost vacuities. So I guess it's seeing tunnels underneath the cellar that should not be there. So it's just like when I'm bad at a video game, I blame the controller. He's saying my device must not be working because I don't like what's happening.
As they left the basement, the floor seemed hollow to Georg, more hollow than normal. And then he went upstairs, started a fire in the fireplace, and then they talked about Wilmarth's trip. Georg brought up the Shadow Over Innsmouth, but Wilmarth was, again, evasive about the legitimacy of the story.
Yeah, he says the guy was about and his cousin in the asylum disappeared, so all that actually did happen. Well, at least those people disappeared.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know, but maybe they're swimming around all happy in the ocean.
Georg gave Wilmarth the mail that he had gotten there before for him. Then finally, he announced that he was going to tell Georg the details about the Miskatonic Project that he was so vague about in his letters. Wilmarth explained that he and the others had witnessed all the things from Lovecraft stories, but when it comes to any kind of proof, it always disappeared. The Mego and Wilbur Whateley's bodies, they disintegrated, you know, when they died.
Right.
So there's also lost artifacts, things that they would find, but then that would mysteriously vanish. For some reason, proving these things true has been almost impossible. He says, if they do exist, they are so unimaginably powerful and resourceful, they might be, and he looked around sharply, anywhere at any moment.
Ooh. And, you know, another thought I had at this moment is that maybe Lovecraft is some kind of master showman, actually. He's created this character of himself, all of these attributes that we know about him, but he's also deploying confederates to meet up with impressionable cranks and start rumors about the truth of his creations. I mean, this trip Wilmarth just went on was basically a roadshow. He stopped in all of those places to talk about these things, and I thought maybe he's actually Lovecraft, the intrepid showman, pretending to be one of his own characters. This actually is Lovecraft here right now.
Well, that's funny that you say that, because later, I won't jump ahead.
Yeah.
Then he said, take Cthulhu. And this is Georg's comment. I couldn't help starting as I heard the word pronounced for the first time in my life. The harsh, dark, monosyllabic growl it came to was so very like the sound that had originally come to me from my imagination or my subconscious or my otherwise unremembered dreams. Monosyllabic? I know Lovecraft tells us how to pronounce Cthulhu in a letter to Rimmel, which I will reread for you here. The actual sound, as nearly as any human organs could imitate it or human letters record it, may be taken to something like Cthulhu. With the first syllable pronounced gutturally and very thickly, the U is like that in full, and the first syllable is not unlike Kalul in the sound, hence the H represents the guttural thickness. But of course, it can't be reproduced accurately by human organs. But it distinctly says not monosyllabic, but definitely not a normal or easy to pronounce word.
I mean, I think I have a way to make both of those work, because I think what he's saying is that the two-syllable word is the best way to approximate it. So this is the best way a human could imitate it or human letters record it is a two-syllable thing. But the actual word being approximated is monosyllabic. Mm. So you can say the name, you can say the word crew or clue. It's one syllable. I think that consonant, that R or that L, the consonant is that thule sound that humans can't make. We don't have the equipment in our bodies to make this thule sound. That's our approximation of it. So that's why it's Cthulhu. But think of it more like crew or clue. If you could say that thule sound, it would be one syllable. That's how I reconcile.
All right. Okay, good. I like that. That sounds good.
You got it.
Wilmarth said that Cthulhu exists not in the spaces we know, but between them. The oceans or maybe tunnels?
It is those monstrous underground cavern and tunnel worlds, not all from Cthulhu by any means, that I have been assigned to investigate with the geoscanner. Partly because I was the first to hear of them from old Akeley, and also, merciful creator, from the Pluto man who masked as him. Great worlds of unknown life down there. Blue-litten Kinyan, red-litten Yoth, and black, lightless Nkai, which was Tsathogua's home, and even stranger inner spaces litten by colors from space and from Earth's nighted core. That's how I guessed the colors in your childhood dreams or nightmares, or personality exchanges, my dear Fisher. I've glimpsed them also in the geoscanner, where they are, however, most fugitive and difficult to discern. His voice trailed off tiredly, just as my own concern became most feverishly intense with his mention of personality exchanges.
He was stuck worrying about personality exchanges. I'm wondering if Akeley went on to fight crime after A Whisper in Darkness as this Pluto Man character, you know? You know, a lot of people think Pluto Man's a hero, but the press keeps saying he's...
No, if you remember from Whisper in Darkness, he thought he was talking to Akeley, but he was talking to Amigo, who are from Yawgoth.
Right.
Pluto is basically Yawgoth.
By day, mild-mannered Amigo puts the face and hands on Pluto Man, uses those hands to slap evil.
All right. Yeah, it makes sense the way you explain it. Georg was keen on taking the drug that night so that they could see this otherworldly stuff, but Wilmarth felt that they weren't ready. They needed to check out the area with the geoscanner first.
After he gets the geoscanner working properly, they go out hiking and cavern hunting. I liked this bit. Our expedition did turn out to be a glorious one, at least until almost its very end. The Hollywood Hills put on their most youthfully winning face. Even the underlying crumbling worm-eaten corruptions seemed fresh. It's like, huh? How do these corruptions seem fresh? Hey, check out this corruption. Pretty fresh, right?
Well, maybe it's new or it looks like different than the other old obvious corruptions.
Hey, check out this color white. It's pretty black, right?
So they went out to the hills on paths with Wilmarth stopping and taking readings every so often, finding tunnels at about 15 meters and the like. They drove back to the house, night finally having had fallen. Now, Wilmarth went back to the cellar and did another reading. He came back up haunted, and he told Georg that they had to leave the house as soon as possible. Not just the house, but leave town, head back to Arkham. The readings he made before were legit, but his most recent readings told him that the floor was only centimeters thick now. Something is carving up from the tunnel below the house, and Wilmarth tells him they've got about enough time to pack, but then after that, they got to get the hell out of there.
And they pack up and drive away, and that's the end of the story.
Yeah, great story. Nope. Georg went down to the cellar to check it out and sensed that things were coming to a head. He told Wilmarth that he thought that they should stay there and do the drug to find out what the hell was really going on. Wilmarth, for some crazy reason, agreed to it.
I know. Well, Wilmarth, it was strange that he changed his mind so suddenly. But he had said nowhere is safe, like in the country, but Arkham. And even Arkham is messed up. It's just that there's more people there that could maybe defend us. Yeah. So I think it's just that even if they hit the road, whatever this is would maybe get them anyway.
They ate, they sat by the fire and opened up the package that they got from Rodea. It's that silver casket that this whole story comes from. Mm-hmm. Remember, it was found in a silver casket, which is like a little small box with a lid on it from the beginning of the story. In it is a letter from Georg's father. The letter was written when Georg was 13 years old, but it explains he will get this box when he's 25. He tells of a woman that Georg's father was in love with when he was 25 years old. This woman wasn't Georg's mother. It was some other woman that his father was in love with before he met his mom. This woman died of consumption. Georg's father explains that he was pining at her grave when he had a daydream that he went through the ground and he found her and joined with her full body? Mm. Does that mean sex? Is he having ghost sex?
It seemed like that, yeah. Full bodily union. Sex. Full bodily union, yeah, that's right.
And he says, "It is not black down there, my son, as one would think. There are glorious colors, waters blue, metals bright red and yellow, rocks green and brown." He says he learned to be a fish of the earth, and that is why he was so good at dowsing.
That was all pretty cool stuff. Liber also writes, "We kissed farewell forever, Lorchen." That's who the woman was, Lorchen and I. "And I swam down and on her night of dreams, exulting in my strength like some old kobold breasting the rock." And, you know, I'm still kind of upset that Ken Height called me a nerd a few weeks ago when I was talking about my band, the Kobold and the Co-Beautiful. Well, check it out. Fritz Leimer would have thought my band was pretty cool. Kenneth. In all seriousness, you know that band, the Libertines? You've heard
yes.
of them? They actually used to be called the Libertines, I just found
out. What?
They were teenage fans of Fritz Leimer. They had a song about this story.
That's some good backstory. Mm-hmm. Georg's father in the letter tells Georg that he too has this power and that he will use it wisely as nature's acolyte. "Make your mind white, with or without some lovely woman's help. Now burst the gate of dreams." So after he reads this, it says burst the gate of dreams. Now, does this mean literally? Like break the floor in the cellar? Georg's not sure.
So his dad is some kind of worm guy, right? Like that's what's going on?
No. What do you mean?
He says that he went down through the earth.
Yeah.
But isn't this sort of what was happening in the story so far, where Georg is having these dreams about the worm guys, and then he saw the worm guys eating his body, right?
Uh-huh.
So, and then his father fell through into the tunnels. They couldn't get to him. But is it that these worm things eat up on you, and then they absorb your consciousness, and then that's why you can swim around in the earth, see all the true colors of the minerals? I mean, I think that's what it is, right? It's like the chthonic version of Innsmouth, chthonic meaning of the earth. Like, Innsmouth, they run down and they become deep ones and swim in the ocean.
Yeah, yeah. I don't think that is how it happens, because Georg's able to do this already, and he wasn't eaten by any of the worms or anything like that. Like, you have to get down there before the worms can get to you. So I think it was just him realizing that, you know, like he was born with this gift, and that by him going down there and having these revelations, he was becoming his spiritual self, which is like one of these worm things. So like you're born a human, but the inside of you is like
I see what you're saying.
A worm creature.
So there's no creature that consumes him and becomes him. He already is the worm creature.
I think he's already the worm creature, and it's a dream, so it's not. I don't think they were literally eating his body.
No, I didn't think so either. My thought was that it was sort of like if you're a deep one hybrid or whatever, you would dream of the ocean while you were still human, and then eventually you would go into the ocean when you become the thing. Whereas this, he was dreaming about the creatures, And then his father says, like, you know, oh, now I'm going over. You know, he crossed over. Just like with the ghouls, too. It's a very Lovecraftian idea. You know?
Right, yeah.
You have visions of their world, and then you become that thing, and then you enter their world.
Well, and he does. His father actually got sucked up in the earth, and they said that he was dead, the doctor, but maybe he wasn't dead, and maybe he turned into this thing and was an actual literal worm.
You know, Georg keeps talking about, I'm having visions of reuniting with my father, so I think that that's kind of the idea. Like, his dad is down there swimming around in the earth.
Yeah, but it could be more like a spiritual version of him.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Like a astral version of him that's a worm creature. I don't know, but it's vague and weird, which is it should be.
Yeah.
So having read this to Wilmarth, Wilmarth said that these colors that he spoke about are the same colors that he sees in the geoscope. Mm. So after that revelation, someone knocked at the door, and it was a telegram which read,
Lovecraft is dead. Stop. The whippoorwills did not sing. Stop. Take courage. Stop. Danforth.
If you remember from Dunwich Horror, the legend, if the whippoorwills sing, they got your soul. Mm-hmm. If they don't sing, your soul got away. Lovecraft's soul was free.
I guess that's what it means. Or they were just like, this guy's an atheist, forget it, there's nothing to pick up here. You know? Or we're reading it one way because it's a telegram, but maybe it's actually, you know, we're assuming stop is just stop, like you'd read it in a telegram, but maybe it's saying stop the whippoorwills. You know, like they're on a rampage. I was actually surprised the story didn't go in that direction. But
yeah, big surprise. With this news, Wilmarth believed that they must look into the abyss together. They had to confront whatever this thing was. I'm not sure why the news of Lovecraft's death prompted this.
Well, Wilmarth was the one who produced the telegram. Somebody came with it, but he was the one that read it out. So I'm thinking, is this just a prop, part of his gig, his road thing here, you know? So it's whatever it takes to get this guy to take drugs.
Oh.
So he says, oh, Lovecraft's dead. And then if it didn't work, he would have said, oh, wait a minute, I got another telegram. Drugs are cool. Stop. They make you more attractive. Stop. We got to take these drugs now, man.
Huh. Okay, this is interesting. Yeah, because that plays into what happens up here very soon. They took the drug, and Georg asked if maybe some of these creatures could be benign.
Most of our comrades did not find them so, he replied judiciously. Though, of course, there's our Innsmouth hero. What has he really found in Yahaneth Lay? Wonder and glory? Who knows? Who can say he knows? Or old Akeley out in the stars? Is his brain suffering the tortures of the damned in its shining metal cylinder? Or is it perpetually exalted by ever-changing true visions of infinity? And what did poor Shuggoth Stampeded Danforth really think he saw beyond the two horrific mountain chains down there before he got amnesia? And is that last a blessing or a curse? God, he and I are suited to each other. The mind-smitten helping the nerve-shattered. Fit nurses for felines.
Georg then said that he had the strange notion that Wilmarth and Lovecraft were actually the same person.
Mm-hmm.
Your idea, Pfeiffer, that Wilmarth doesn't really exist. It's actually Lovecraft going around tricking people.
Or he means... What did you think he meant by that? If it's not my crazy theory.
I don't know. I just thought it was very weird. Maybe that because Wilmarth was a creation of Lovecraft, that the author was saying that.
Yeah. Or are they all living within this, you know, Lovecraft is ultimately everybody's Lovecraft. They're all living in his stories, actually. So it's like Tron or something, actually. You know, Lovecraft's a user, and they're all in his stories. And he just, with these drugs, he just got a glimpse of it. Wilmarth isn't Wilmarth, he's Lovecraft. Oh my God, if he looked around outside, everybody's Lovecraft. You know, maybe that's what's going on.
Could be. They fell asleep and then woke up. The fire had burned out, but there was this buzzing sound that Georg was hearing. Wilmarth was still sleeping and talking. He was saying, pulpy tentacled head, Cthulhu Fatagan, the wrong geometry, the polarizing miasma, the prismatic distortion, Cthulhu relay, the positive blackness, the living nothingness. And this was freaking Georg out so much that he woke Wilmarth up, which, of course, you aren't supposed to do, because if you do, then you will remember what was actually going on in the dream.
His eyes came open wide in his white face, and his mouth clamped shut as he came up with a powerful shove of his bent arms against the chair's arms, which his hands had been clutching. It was as if it were happening in slow motion, though paradoxically it also seemed to be happening quite swiftly. He gave me a last mute look of utter horror. And then he turned and ran, taking fantastically long strides out through the door, which his outstretched hand threw wide ahead of him, and disappeared into the night.
Wilmarth pulled a Wilmarth.
Yeah, that's right. He Wilmarthed it.
And he just ran away. You know, Things get weird and he just takes off. After Wilmarth left, he could hear the buzzing, and then the buzzing formed words, Cthulhu Fatagan, they were saying, and have been saying, and are saying now, and will forever. The spider tunnels, the black infinities, the colors in pitch darkness, the tiered towers of Yugoth, the glittering centipedes, the winged worms. He decided to write this missive and then afterwards go down to the cellar and use the sledge on the floor, and that is the end of the letter.
Yeah, so Wilmarth just bugged out because he saw something scary?
Yeah, that's it.
Just knew he was in danger, I guess.
Well, he pulled a Wilmarth. Now the wraparound...
Faster than Pluto Man!
Now the wraparound tells us that on March 16th, there was an earthquake up in Vulture's Roost that was very localized. It didn't affect anything else around there, just gave small tremors. Fisher's Folly had completely collapsed. Not a brick was left standing, and most of it was just gone, as if it had been sucked into a large hole. Soon afterwards, it was filled and cemented over. Not long after that, people rebuilt on the spot.
The body of the owner, a quietly spoken, crippled young man named Georg Reuter Fisher, was discovered flat on its face in the edge of the rubble with hands thrown out the metal casket by one of them, as though he had been trying to flee outdoors when caught by the collapse. His death, however, was attributed to a slightly earlier accident or insane act of self-destruction involving acid, of which his eccentric father was once known to have kept a supply. It was well that easy identification was made possible by his conspicuously twisted right foot, for when the body was turned over, it was discovered that something had eaten away the entire front of his face, and also those portions of his skull and jaw, and the entire forebrain.
And that's it.
That's the end of the story.
Well, so what happened?
Man, I'm not sure. This is my take on it, is that he went down there, cracked it open, the wormy things came out. He took the acid, poured it on himself to try and get rid of his physical body to, like, become a worm thingy.
Okay.
And then maybe it burst out of his face.
Okay.
I don't know. That's my guess. I have honestly no idea. I don't know if we're ever really supposed to know exactly what happened, because this is a very weird capital W tale.
Oh, definitely, yeah. There's this slightly earlier accident involving acid. Hmm. It says the entire front of his face and the portion of the skull and jaw and the forebrain were eaten away. Something had eaten them away. And I know acid can eat something away, but it says something had eaten away. They'd already mentioned the acid, so clearly they mean some kind of animal or something.
Right.
So that's why I guess I thought the worm devoured his forebrain. And then he was just the worm. Although if the worms are of some kind of nature that they can pass through the earth, why would they be eating anything?
Yeah. It's a little confusing. I'm not sure.
I did like that notion that was mentioned, and I don't know if we talked about it or not, about Cthulhu can turn into mist. As such, he can turn into anything. We think of him as the sea creature, but he could be swimming around in the earth. He could be doing, you know what I mean?
Sure.
He could turn to mist, he could pass through soil.
Yeah,
I thought
of
that
course.
Was kind of interesting.
Yeah.
Well, this story, I thought, beat out the other pastiche offerings we've had on the menu, and we've had quite a few. Shay and Belknap Long and Robert Block. This one I liked the best. I want to thank Andrew Lehman once again for donating his beautiful voice to each episode of the show that he appears on.
Yes.
It really is the heartbeat that keeps this this body running efficiently. Well, it's not doing so well now, is it?
Thank you so much, Andrew, and please check out Voluminous and all the fine products over at the H.P. Lovecraft Historical Society.
Yes.
I'd also like to thank some of our patrons.
I would too, and I'm going to start by thanking Stefan V.
I'd like to thank Mia Foverskov.
I'd like to thank Roy Batty. Uh-oh. Wait, isn't Roy Batty in it?
Roy Batty's from Blade Runner.
Wait, it's 2000. It's 2020, man. Roy Batty's not. Is that a ghost android?
It's an android's ghost.
Oh my
God. A patron of our show. Thank you, Roy. I'd like to thank Lauren Monks. Oh, Lauren, I know her. She lives down in Petersboro.
Oh, killer. Thanks, Lauren. I would like to thank Austin Merritt.
I would like to thank Maxwell McCormick.
Amanda Fuller, thank you so much.
I'd like to thank Thomas Panzarello.
I'd like to thank Nathan Hanna.
And Hobby ADHD, thank you so much.
That's all we've got for this week. We're going to be back with more Libertines next week. What do we got lined up?
To Arkham and the Stars.
To Arkham and the Stars. I wonder if that'll be Lovecraftian at all. Well, hopefully it's got a whippoorwill attack at the end, you know?
Because this story had the same setup as Tootsie, but it didn't have the third act Whippoorwill attack that's in it.
No,
so I was confused. Anyway, that's all we got. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
I'm Chris Lackey, and you've been listening to the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast.
At hppodcraft.com.
hppodcraft.com.